to give a kind of introductory talk about what we mean by human trafficking, and I'm conscious that in the room there will be some people who maybe know a lot about what I'm going to say already, and I ask you to bear with me on that because some of it will be pretty basic. If you look behind me, you'll see a postcard. I picked that up in Vilnius about 12 years ago, and this was at a time when, at least in the European context, when people spoke about human trafficking, they really meant the trafficking of women from Eastern to Western Europe for the purpose of sexual exploitation. And that, in fact, is only one small part of human trafficking nowadays. There are an awful lot of people trafficked for labour exploitation. In the UK, where I come from, there are probably more people trafficked for labour exploitation than for sexual exploitation. But there's no doubt in my mind that sexual exploitation is one of the biggest forms of exploitation that trafficking is used for. This postcard is interesting because it was part of a small project funded partly by the International Organization for Migration. And they produced these postcards, and I don't know how clearly you can see it, but it's like a picture of a young woman being held like a puppet with strings. And on the back of the postcard there was a phone number where you could call if you wanted to, if you felt threatened or in danger or at risk, and you could call and ask for some help. And the question was how to get these postcards to the target audience, being young women who might be at risk. And I thought the idea was brilliant. They had to find one place where you could put them where the traffickers wouldn't find them. At least, hopefully, they wouldn't. And they put them in the women's toilets, in the bars in Vilnius. And I thought that was quite a smart idea. I did not personally check the women's toilets to see if they were there, but that's where they put them. And that, so that was awareness raising 14 years ago. Nearly 15 years later, we're still trying to raise awareness about the risks of human trafficking. And in the context of sexual exploitation, I can tell you that the way that this is done is evolving. Last week, or 2 weeks ago in Strasbourg, one of my colleagues on Greta, who's a prosecutor from Norway, told us about trafficking and internet streaming. In other words, the customer will stay in, usually his, but in their, by their computer in their home, which in this case was in Norway, but it could be anywhere, it could be here in Lisbon, and he's paying somebody in, for example, Manila, that was the example that we were given, to sexually abuse a child or a young woman, or even to get them to abuse each other. And this is streamed live on the computer. Now, the problem about this from a prosecutorial perspective is that it's streamed, it's live, nothing is kept on the computer. So you don't need to download it. And this person who is being prosecuted in Norway has been apparently exploiting about one person a day for a year without leaving his computer or his home. So when we talk about sexual exploitation, it's not just the traditional image of some English guy is going to Riga or Prague or Amsterdam for a weekend. It's much, much wider than it was previously thought. I'll keep looking around because I just don't trust that the slides work when it's behind my back. You know, it's just, I always think there's something dodgy going on. When we talk about then trafficking, I'm not going to spend much time on this, but this is just to illustrate to you how people are trafficked, or rather why they're trafficked, what for. And it's not just for sexual exploitation. There are many, many ways it can be done. And in the UK, for example, where I come from, there's a lot of trafficking for agricultural labour. And a very recent decision of the European Court of Human Rights found that Greece was in violation of its obligations for allowing men to be trafficked from Bangladesh to work in fruit farms in the Athens region. So please bear that in mind. But let's come back to the main point. A lot of people confuse trafficking with smuggling. Sometimes it depends on which language you're speaking, but in the UK, in the mass media, they're often confused. And I just want to stress they are two different things. When we're talking about the people who are trying to come across the Mediterranean from Libya, or trying to get to Greece from Turkey, they are on the whole being smuggled. They have consented to this process, albeit it's a very risky one. They may die on the way. Certain things may happen to them on the way. And they may end up being trafficked, because the line between the two is not always that clear cut. But the crucial difference is that, however exploitative that process is, those people are being smuggled. And they may end up being trafficked, they may not. But that's the crucial thing I want you to remember, that trafficking is a process involving a number of actors. So if you imagine you'll have somebody recruiting in country X, in somewhere in Europe, to bring somebody to Western Europe for sexual exploitation, there'll be somebody recruiting there. There might be somebody providing the transport. There might be somebody else providing accommodation. And on the way, because they'll come by bus, it's cheaper. And of course, when you do that, you need to make sure that people that you're going to exploit are not going to escape. So you might lock them in their accommodation. My point is that everybody's in on the game. It's not just the person who's exploiting them at the end. And it's very important to remember this process involving a number of actors when it comes to understanding the legal definition of trafficking, which I'm going to come to just in a moment. But you can have, I need to move on there. You can have recruitment agencies, you can have friends or relatives involved, people running hotels and so on. Now, what is the definition of trafficking? The definition that I put up there behind me is the same whether one is looking at European Union law or the Council of Europe law. The two main instruments are those up there in red. The Council of Europe Convention that was adopted in 2005, and next year it will be 10 years since it came into force. And in the EU, the directive that was adopted in 2011. And of course, every member state of the European Union is also a party to the Council of Europe Convention. The last one to sign up was the Czech Republic, which did so a few months ago. And they use the same definition, which is three elements. And I want to just take you through that. You'll see that there are those three elements are the act, the method, and the purpose, or the motivation. So if you look at what it says there, it says trafficking in persons shall mean, and then we have the act. It's the recruitment, transportation, transfer, harbouring, or receipt of persons. And that word or is crucial. It means that anybody who's involved, from the recruiter through the person providing transport to the person who takes control of the victim at the end, is a trafficker. If the definition said and receipt of persons, rather than or, it would be totally different, because you could do all of those things except one, and you would never be a trafficker. So the or is absolutely vital, and everybody who is in on the game, everybody who knows that this person is going to be exploited, and who knowingly participates in that, is a trafficker. But then, how do they do it? What is the means or the method? And it lists them there, by means of threat or use of force, or other forms of coercion. Abduction, fraud, deception, the abuse of power. It could be, for example, somebody who's a guardian of somebody else who misuses that power, or of a position of vulnerability, or of the giving or receiving of payments or benefits to achieve the consent of a person having control over another. Now, what does that mean? Imagine you're in the situation where you go back to your country somewhere in Eastern Europe. This is where you come from, and you've made it big. And you go to the family who are quite poor, and you say, look, I can get your daughter a job as an au pair. She'll be living with a nice family, she'll go to school, she'll get paid, she'll get time off. And I can fix it, it's no problem. I know people who need an au pair. And the family agree, because this looks like a good opportunity. Maybe the parents are unemployed, maybe both parents are not around. And so they agree in good faith that their daughter should go to work as an au pair somewhere in another country, Western Europe. Everything's fine. 2 days later, she's in a brothel. That's how it can work. And that's achieving consent of somebody who has this authority. They did not consent to the girl being exploited, of course not, but they did not think that was going to happen. And then, what's it for? For the purpose of exploitation. Now, the definition that we have, both in the EU directive and the Council of Europe Convention, is not an exhaustive list. It gives examples of exploitation, such as for sexual exploitation, for the labour exploitation, for the removal of organs, that kind of thing. But it's very important that it is only examples that it gives. It is not an exhaustive list, because this definition was first adopted in the year 2000 in an instrument adopted by the United Nations in Palermo called the Palermo Protocol on Trafficking. And since then, we have found many, many more ways of exploiting people. Well, I haven't when I say we, but traffickers have found many, many more ways to exploit people than were listed in the convention. So we have people being trafficked for forced criminality. And the kind of example I have is, for example, children being brought from Romania to steal wallets, pickpockets in the UK. They're under the age of criminal responsibility. There's not a lot that the state can do with them when they're caught, and sometimes they're caught. We have people being trafficked for identity theft, where credit cards are taken out in their names, or debit cards, or mobile phone contracts, and big debts are amassed. None of these things was thought about when this definition was adopted. I just mentioned internet streaming, which that was not known when this instrument was first drafted nearly 20 years ago. So it's very important that we don't have an exhaustive list of the types of exploitation, because I can guarantee that 2 or 3 years from now, we will be learning how to deal with some other type of exploitation. I don't know what the latest one will be. In the UK, one of the big things that has come up is a kind of labour exploitation, is nearly always young men working in car washes. You can find it all over the country, hand car wash, rather than driving your car through a machine. And this has come out in a big way in the last 2 or 3 years in the UK. And I've taken my car to one of them once, and they're all Polish. I know, because I speak Polish, I can hear them. And they're young guys, they do a nice job, but the question is, to what extent are they being forced to do that? I'm sure that they have not all been trafficked, but we do know that some of them have been. And that is the point, okay? And it's cheaper to pay people a small amount of money to do this than to set up a big automatic garbage. So we have those three elements. And the important point to note is that where you have any of those means used to exploit somebody, such as through coercion or fraud or abduction, any apparent consent of that person is irrelevant, because the person may not even realise that they have been trafficked or that they are being exploited. They may say, yeah, I agreed to this, it's not as good as I thought it would be. And remember also that not all trafficking cases are extreme ones. Some of them are very extreme, but some of them are not, they're a bit more grey, and then it's maybe not so easy to actually convince the person even that they have been trafficked. So it's important to remember that consent, any apparent consent, is not legally relevant. That person is still being trafficked. Now, there's the definition. Sorry, I've moved a bit too fast. And here's the issue of exploitation. As I said, in the directive, it says exploitation shall include, as a minimum, those different types of exploitation that I mentioned, but it's only a minimum. Now, when it comes to the protection of people who have been sexually exploited or are at risk of being sexually exploited, and it's important to remember this when we're talking about trafficking, it's not just those who have been trafficked in the past, it's those who are at risk as well. And the state has significant protection and assistance obligations to all of those people. And this came out very clearly in a case decided by the European Court of Human Rights almost 8 years ago, in 2010, Radsev against Cyprus and Russia. We don't need to go into the facts, but it concerned a young woman who had been trafficked to Cyprus from Russia for sexual exploitation, and she died there eventually. She fell from a balcony or was pushed. But the point was that Cyprus had not done enough to protect that person. And the court, European Court of Human Rights, said at paragraph 284, the state's human rights obligations include having in place legislation adequate to ensure the practical and effective protection of the rights of victims or potential victims of trafficking. So not just those who have been trafficked already, but those who might be trafficked in the future. And this can have very practical significance. If you're a police officer, you might be working on duty in the middle of the night at 2 o'clock, there are just two of you there, and somebody comes in saying they've escaped from someplace and they believe that they've been exploited. You, as an agent of the state, have a protection obligation to that person. It might mean something as immediate as that. It does not necessarily mean getting immediate social security or something like that. It might mean actual physical protection at that moment, which means that frontline professionals, such as police, social workers, so on, people working with NGOs who might come into contact with trafficked people, need to know when they do so, need to recognise that this is a person who might be in danger. Because if you don't identify that person as being at risk, you will not take the appropriate action. That is why in Greta, we are we are monitoring how countries carry out their anti-trafficking obligations, and that includes protection of those at risk. We ask those questions: what kind of training do you have in place for police officers, for border officials, that sort of thing, in order to enable them to identify people who are at risk? Because if you don't identify them, you will never be able to do anything to help. And this case, Rantsev against Cyprus and Russia, was very important. I'm sorry there's a lot of text there, but it's the red part that's the most important. And it said that Article 4 made certain circumstances require a state to take operational measures to protect victims or potential victims of trafficking. That is the crucial thing that I would say coming out of that. And I'm not going to inflict too much of this on you. But I want to draw your attention to this document that was adopted by the European Commission in the year 2010. And there's somebody in the room here sitting in the front row who participated in drafting this, Evelyn Popes from Vienna. I also participated in it. And we actually set out in two or three pages what were the main obligations of countries to protect people who have been trafficked. In other words, we were trying to take this massive judgment of the European Court of Human Rights and make it a bit more user-friendly. So the easy version for those who can never be bothered to go and read the case, which is most of us, right? Don't have the time. This was on the EU website for quite a long time, but for some reason they took it down. Maybe the EU has changed its policy, I'm not sure. Maybe it doesn't approve of protecting trafficked people anymore. I'm not sure what the motivation was. But it's no longer on the website, but it has been published for those of you who have access to it, and it's online in this journal at the bottom there. Now, let me come in particular to, I've gone through the definition. What I wanted to do now is say a bit about the protection of victims of sexual exploitation. And I want to refer again both to the EU Directive and the Council of Europe Convention. They have a lot in common, but some of them are a little bit stronger. In some ways, the EU Directive is stronger. In some ways, the Council of Europe Convention is stronger. But they both apply, because as I told you earlier, every EU member state has also ratified the Council of Europe Convention. So one needs to be aware of the substance of both instruments and what they require of countries when it comes to protecting people from sexual exploitation. The directive in Article 11 does not specifically mention sexual exploitation, but it has general measures on protection which clearly will be applicable here. So there has to be assistance for trafficked people before, during and after criminal proceedings, as soon as there are reasonable grounds to believe the person has been trafficked. Now that's important. We're not saying that you must positively identify the person as having been trafficked. You must have reasonable grounds to believe they have been trafficked. And that can happen a lot sooner before a positive identification takes place, because to achieve a positive identification or a definite identification, you might need to spend quite a bit more time to find out quite a bit more about the facts. So the crucial thing here, the trigger for this, is that there are reasonable grounds to believe that the person has been trafficked. And it is not conditional upon the person cooperating with the prosecution. In some countries that we are monitoring, still to some extent, and I'm not going to name any countries, still to some extent, the assistance that is given is predicated upon the victim agreeing to prosecute, agreeing to cooperate with the authorities. Now, I think it's very good if a victim cooperates with the authorities, because it will be much easier, one imagines, to obtain the necessary evidence to secure a conviction. But there can be many reasons why a person is unable or unwilling to cooperate, and that can involve fear, it can involve all sorts of things. But another thing to remember is that cooperation does not necessarily mean being a witness in court. It can mean giving information. There are different ways of construing this. But the important point to remember is that the person does not have to agree to cooperate to be entitled to those measures of protection and assistance. And what do we mean by that assistance? What is it? The assistance must be enough to include, quote, at least, this is the minimum in the directive, standards of living capable of ensuring the victim's subsistence through measures such as the provision of appropriate and safe accommodation and material assistance, as well as necessary medical treatment, including psychological assistance, counselling and information, and translation and interpretation services where appropriate. This is quite a lot. because the person who's been trafficked might have quite significant needs. They might have suffered quite severe physical abuse, sexual abuse, psychological abuse. And it can be quite difficult also to, for a state sometimes to fulfill all of these obligations, because I've been in some quite small countries. And here I can name the country because it's nothing critical. I'm thinking about Macedonia. Macedonia, you'll be aware, 2 years ago, was a major transit state for people coming from Greece trying to reach the European Union. Because once you're in Greece, to get north, you have to go through Macedonia. And they were coming in vast numbers. And the Macedonian authorities were simply overwhelmed with these numbers. They were not able, even with the best will in the world, to deal with it all in a systematic way. And the obligation of a member of a state is also to identify trafficked people, and they simply could not, because one of our questions was, how did you try to identify people who were at risk? If you had unaccompanied minors, what steps did you take to find out if they were being trafficked or were they simply unaccompanied minors? And there wasn't an awful lot they could do about it sometimes. And think also about the need to have translators. You have somebody coming from maybe a country in North Africa whose first language is Arabic. Now, the Macedonians don't have that many interpreters, it's a small country, who might be available round the clock to deal with that. Let alone a big country, which maybe has lots of people. In the UK, we are isolated from this. We're a big country and nobody can get there because we're on an island. Plus, we're leaving the European Union, so we're going to be safe from everything. Right? So it's a real... But for a small country on the front line, this can be very, very problematic. Even with the best will in the world to do all they can to protect trafficked people. And I was sure that the Macedonians were really trying to do a decent job. So I'm in no way being critical of that country. Right? So the assistance obligation is one thing. To actually give effect to it is another. And another issue that we've come up with in some countries is that they are providing this assistance, but very often it's as part of temporary or limited projects or programs that are funded or partially funded by the European Union or by the United States or some other body or country. That's fine. It's better if these programs happen than they do not happen at all. But they're not sustainable in the long term if they're always dependent on money coming from Brussels or Washington. One of the things we're constantly trying to get across to states is that they have signed these obligations. They have signed these instruments. They have obligations under these instruments. And they cannot depend on the European Union or the United States or some other benefactor to enable them in the long term to give effect to their obligations. In the meantime, of course, they have 100 other priorities apart from trafficking of human beings. So there's this game that we're constantly playing to try to persuade states. Look, first of all, you have these obligations. Second, we want you to give effect to them, especially when it comes to protection and assistance. And third, if this is going to work in the long term, we do not think it can be dependent upon the goodwill of Brussels or Washington or some other donor. This is the kind of thing we're dealing with all the time. So it's one thing for me to stand here and tell you that these are the rules. I can tell you that applying them in practice is very problematic, and not just with small countries either, with some pretty big, wealthy countries. Okay? Now, what do we mean by it? Let's move on. Got that off my chest. Protection during criminal proceedings. What does that mean in practice? There must be access to legal counselling and legal representation, including for claiming compensation. And I can tell you that apart from two or three countries, the issue of getting effective access to compensation is a catastrophe in most European countries. I have 3 law degrees, and if I had to claim compensation in the UK, I wouldn't know where to start. I would need to go and get a lawyer to help me, because I'm just not involved in the system, and it is extremely complex. Imagine if you've been trafficked to another country, you're maybe not very well educated, you don't speak the language, you have no means at all. Unless there is a system in place designed to assist people who have been trafficked, to help them find a way through the system, they will never succeed. And I've been in some quite wealthy countries monitoring them, and some public official will tell me in an offhand manner, oh, of course, everybody in this country has the right to seek compensation when they've been harmed. Sure. Let's just see how it works in practice. We all know that's a joke, and I've even said, come on, you're joking. And sometimes they even have the grace to look embarrassed when they say it. Because we all know that it's a joke. There are some countries where that's not true. But there are some countries where it is possible to get effective access to compensation. And there have been some notable successes, but even in that case, quite often it's been done with the systematic and significant help of some NGO or other civil society organisation. So that is a real problem, the compensation, in many, many countries. Okay. There's also a need to avoid secondary victimisation, and by that I mean not, for example, requiring a person to undergo the same type of interview 4, 5, 6 times. Now, I don't deal directly with trafficked people, and I'm not an expert in this area, but I've dealt with plenty of people who do deal directly with trafficked people. And they've also told me, of course, one should not try to interview people too often, because this can be traumatic. On the other hand, a person will not always be able to tell his or her story in one go. Sometimes you will have to do it again. So there's a balance to be struck, and you need to have people who are experienced in that, who are able effectively to get the person's story, to get the really hard, relevant information in as sensitive way as possible. That's why I don't do it, because I'm from Scotland, we don't do sensitive, right? So you need to avoid those sorts of things. Measures to protect child victims. The point here is that the directive you'll see has quite significant measures to protect child victims. There are 4 articles there, 13 to 16. I'm not going to inflict all 4 of them on you, I'm just summarising them here. And in any case, I have to stop in 5 or 6 minutes. But the directive recognises the particular vulnerability of child victims, both in general and during criminal proceedings, and it imposes a duty to take account of the personal and special circumstances of unaccompanied child victims. And this is a real issue that concerns Greta. We are making a special visit to Hungary in the week before Christmas to visit the border area between Hungary and Serbia, because we have significant concerns about the way that the people coming into Hungary, when they can get in, we have significant concerns about the way that they are being treated, and also that we think that there's not enough being done to identify unaccompanied minors who might be at risk. We think that any unaccompanied minor is, of course, at risk, but some are more at risk than others. Now, that's a directive. The Council of Europe Convention also has certain obligations on protection and assistance, and there's a duty under Article 10 to have personnel who are trained to identify and help victims. This comes back to the point I made earlier about people need to understand when they meet or when they encounter person has been trafficked, they need to be able to recognise this and not just to assume that this is one other person who might be in a bit of trouble. There's also a duty to protect the private life and identity of victims, and that can include also giving them special protection in court. We have quite significant general assistance measures under the Council of Europe Convention. There's the obligation to assist victims in their physical, psychological and social recovery. And behind me out there, I've set out what are the minimum efforts that states must make to achieve this. And again, it talks about standards of living which enable the person to survive. And this goes beyond the Council of Europe Convention and the EU directive, because at least in some cases, and I know with regard to the United Kingdom, it has been found that the United Kingdom has violated its obligation under Article 3 of the European Convention on Human Rights, the obligation not to expose people to inhuman and degrading treatment, because it was not doing enough to assist people who did not have the means to support themselves, asylum seekers, perhaps trafficked people as well. The point I'm making here is that we can go back even to something as fundamental as Article 3 of the European Convention on Human Rights to find the duty of the state to enable people to survive in a dignified way, to give them enough to be able to live properly. The convention also requires states to take due account of the victim's safety and protection needs. It's supposed to provide a recovery and reflection period. This is an area where we have a big problem with a lot of countries, because the recovery and reflection period should be a period of at least 30 days when the person has escaped from their trafficking situation, when she should have time to start to recover, to think about her situation, to consider the options. And we think that at this point, the person should not be under pressure to assist the authorities with an investigation, because she needs to recover and reflect. And we know that some countries during this period do actually encourage the trafficked person to participate in a criminal investigation. On the other hand, one can say that time is of the essence. You have this person now who has escaped. You want the information that they can give you. So this, I am not saying that everything is, that it is clear cut. This can be problematic. But our view is that the protection needs of the trafficked person come first, and recovery and reflection period is part of that. That means that states should issue a residence permit to trafficked people, and it can be on either one of two different bases, either because it's necessary going to the victim's personal situation, or where it's necessary for the victim to assist in criminal proceedings, or it can be in both. The EU also has a directive on this that was adopted 13 years ago. I'm going to come to the financial aspect or the cost aspect just in a second. I want to make one more point here though, from the point of view of protection. Protection does not just mean what the state does to assist those who are on its territory. It also means not exposing a trafficked person to further risk by returning her to the country that she has come from, if she is going to be at risk there. In other words, a trafficked person, if they're in another country, may well be entitled to some form of international protection, either refugee status or subsidiary protection, as we call it in Brussels, what the UNHCR calls complementary protection. The state may be required to allow that person to stay. And in 2006, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees adopted guidelines on this, specifically relating to people who have been trafficked or who are at risk of being trafficked. And these are very detailed. And states need to be aware of that, that they have these protection obligations. Now, the cost of human trafficking, Ramin asked me to look at this. And I looked and I suffered and I tore my blood. I tore out what here I had. And there are so many figures on the cost of human trafficking. Some come from states, some others come from NGOs, some from international organisations. They never tally. I think the only thing that everybody will agree on is that it costs an awful lot. I've put a figure up there on the screen, which comes from the International Labour Organization about 3 years ago, where it estimates that the total illegal profits obtained from the use of forced labour, and that included sexual exploitation, amounts to $150.2 billion a year. That's a lot of money. Even if it's only 10% of that, it's a lot of money. I don't know how they measure this. I don't know if it is accurate. But we can all agree it's an awful lot of money. Now, what are the costs? I looked at it a different way because I frankly did not see the point in me trawling through these different statistics and, in any case, not being a statistician, being unsure what to make of all of them. So I came up with a different way of looking at it. What are the types of costs for the victims? They don't get paid. For a start, the cost of the medical and physical and psychological trauma, which may prevent them working in some other occupation later, may prevent them earning a living for a long time. The cost of shelter and maintenance for those people. In one country that we were monitoring in the last year, and this is quite common, the state will provide sheltered accommodation for trafficked people, but the actual running of the place is done by NGOs who are paid by the state to provide these services. There's nothing wrong with that. It happens in quite a lot of places, as long as it is done properly. Except in this particular country, the state had withdrawn the funding for the NGO to provide those services. And it was not a massive amount of money, it was something like 10,000 euro per year. But the state simply said, we do not have the money. And the NGO had to go and find the money somewhere else. And it managed to do so, but one of our main recommendations to the state was, this is your obligation. It is not the obligation of the NGO. And if you withdraw that funding, you are in violation of your obligations because the maintenance for those people is not there. There's the cost of rehabilitation. Legal assistance for compensation claims. I spoke earlier about compensation. Reintegration, all of that costs money, as well as other costs for the trafficked person. Then what about costs for the state? Two more minutes and I'll be finished, I promise. Training of relevant professionals, which I spoke about earlier. Police, border guards, social workers, medical staff, judges and prosecutors, consular staff. If somebody's applying for a visa to go and work in, for example, just to go and work in another country, or to go and work in a diplomatic household in the UK. We have a significant problem of exploitation, trafficking of domestic workers for labour exploitation, in which is also sometimes accompanied by sexual exploitation, in diplomatic households. And there's been a very big decision by the United Kingdom Supreme Court on this very issue about 3 weeks ago, which I won't go into. Something I haven't mentioned there, unpaid taxes. People who are trafficked for sexual exploitation or labour exploitation, they're working in the black economy. They're not paying taxes. The state is not getting taxes which it is entitled to receive. Other costs for the state, from assisting and helping trafficked people, I've mentioned this already in different ways. I don't think I need to go through that again. And finally, in costs for the state in terms of the criminal law. Costs of investigation and prosecution. Some countries even have specialised anti-trafficking police units, or they have specialised prosecutors or judges dealing with trafficking. That costs money. It takes time for people to develop that level of expertise, to understand how to deal with that, to understand the gravity of the offences that they're dealing with. Because one problem we have in some countries is that some people are getting... people have really trafficked people for serious exploitation, including sexual exploitation, are still getting suspended sentences. They don't spend a day behind bars. We think that's a big problem. So we have the cost for the police, court costs, the cost of maintaining convicted traffickers. They're in prison, you've got to keep them there. Of course, sometimes you can get money back from the traffickers if you're able to seize their assets in time, but it's not always possible. And then something which we think needs to be done in many countries in different ways. Law reform. The legal regimes in many countries that we monitor are still not, in our view, adequate. They do not always conform to the state's obligations. We don't monitor the EU directive, but the EU directive has a lot in common with the Council of Europe Convention. And the domestic law of quite a few states is still not, in our opinion, adequate to meet the state's obligations. Okay, thank you for listening to me. I'll finish there.